Okay, so our next program is on underappreciated risks. There are so many underappreciated risks, and today we can only highlight three of them. Dr. Magda Havas is going to talk about the special risk for children in schools. Dr. Sam Millam is going to talk about the very little-known risk from electrification, some very exciting new research that he's published. And then we have Elizabeth Kelly from the EMF Safety Alliance, who's going to talk about a subject near and dear to people in the Bay Area, the issue of smart meters. So, well, please welcome our panel. Magda?
Thank you very much. Today I'm going to be talking about microwave madness, which is what I think is happening in the schools. And I'm going to start off with a cooking lesson. If you take a potato and put it in a microwave oven at 100% power, it takes about 6 minutes to cook the potato. If you decide to reduce the power to 50%, it'll take you twice as long. It'll take you 12 minutes. And I've tried it, and it works. This is called a time-weighted exposure, and it's something that our federal government simply does not take into consideration. Now, let's look at replacing the potato with children. Let's look at replacing the microwave oven with schools and do a similar type of analysis. The two sources of microwave radiation in schools comes from the information that we have generated within the school, the Wi-Fi routers, the Wi-Fi-enabled computers, smartphones, iPads, and it comes from outside from nearby cell phone antennas. I'm going to talk very briefly about both of these. If we look at the Federal Communication Commission guideline, it allows us to be exposed to microwave radiation for 30 minutes, over a 30-minute average at 1,000 microwatts per centimeter squared. Let's consider this to be 100% power exposure. A school day is 6 hours, and if we calculate exposure using the same thing we did for the baked potato, that brings us down to 1.7% of the guidelines. If we decide to use an entire year, which is about 1,200 hours of exposure, that brings us down to 0.08% of the guidelines. By the way, the Interphone study, the critical hour for exposure over a 10-year period was 1,640 hours over 10 years that resulted in brain tumors. We're talking about children exposed in schools for 1,200 hours exposed to their microwave computers, microwave routers, and cell phone antennas nearby. But children are also exposed to this in their homes. So if we look at a 24-hour period, then we should really be at 0.001% of the guidelines. And indeed, the value here, 0.01%, is what is recommended by a number of organizations around the world for internal exposure. That's much, much lower than what our guidelines are currently. We recently did a study that was published in a book that just came out called The Non-Thermal Effects of Microwave Radiation. So we've simply been talking about heating, but there are a lot of effects that have nothing whatsoever to do with heating. They occur at levels well below our current guidelines. And one of the papers that we published in this was looking at heart rate variability. And four of my co-authors are here, Dr. Jeff Marangel, Dr. Lisa Tully, Camilla Reese, and Libby Kelly are all here. What we did in this particular study is we asked the question, if we expose people to a cordless phone, will it affect their heart? And the reason we looked at this is because a lot of people are complaining about heart palpitations and feeling as though they're having a heart attack when they're exposed to this radiation. So we took a cordless phone, we plugged it in. This particular phone radiates as soon as it's plugged in, and that's one of the problems with a lot of the cordless phones we have here in North America. And we asked the question, will it affect the heart? This cordless phone works at 2.4 gigahertz frequency. That's exactly the same frequency that we have for Wi-Fi in schools. The guidelines for this, as I mentioned, is 1,000. Our maximum exposure for the people who participated in the study was 3. This is 0.3% of our current guidelines. And we expose them for 3 minutes, not 30 minutes, which is what the Federal Communication Guideline is based on. We took a person, hooked them up to a heart monitor, put a cordless phone 2 feet away, plugged it into a live outlet, it radiated microwaves, plugged it into a dead outlet. This was considered our sham exposure. And the computer program we used recorded the heart beat for every single beat, and it shows you the time between beats. So the tall lines are a slower heart rate, the short lines are a faster heart rate. The research was double-blinded, so neither the person participating knew when they were exposed, and neither the person looking at the results, which was Dr. Jeff Maringel, who uses heart rate variability in his clinical practice on thousands of patients over his lifetime of practicing. And basically, this is what we did. We sent him information showing 3 3-minute time intervals for subject A. We told him what the heart rate was for these subjects while they were lying down and resting, 58, 56, and 58 beats per minute. And he would look at this and try to determine whether or not they were exposed to microwaves and whether or not it had an effect on them. And just to have a show you here, there's virtually no difference in any of these intervals. They were exposed to the cordless phone at interval 2 and the sham exposure in interval 3. And this person was non-reactive. Here's subject B. You can see a dramatic effect. You don't have to be a cardiologist in order to interpret this. They were exposed to the cordless phone, and their heartbeat went up from 68 beats a minute to 122 beats per minute while they were lying down within a second of them being exposed to the radiation. We tested 25 subjects in Colorado. 40% of them had either something called tachycardia, which is a rapid heart rate, or arrhythmia, which is an irregular heart rate. And we've since then completed another 75 volunteers, and Dr. Ole Johansson is going to be repeating our study at the Karolinska Institute, which is what you need for scientific validity. But basically, this is showing that microwave radiation at levels well below our current guidelines can instantaneously affect the autonomic nervous system, as shown here by the heart rate. In Ontario, which is where I live, a number of parents are complaining about having kids exposed to Wi-Fi. And if you look at some of the symptoms here, one of them is a racing heart. These parents don't know what to do. They don't want to send their children to the schools. More and more schools are introducing Wi-Fi, so they virtually have to homeschool their children if they don't want them exposed. School boards are not listening to us. They're referring to Health Canada, which refers to the WHO, which refers to ICNIRP, so we really don't have any government support. Two students in the schools that have wireless internet had to have heart monitors. Their cardiologist couldn't figure out what was happening with them, and two of them are on heart medication. A third was scheduled for heart surgery, which the parents prevented from happening. During the summer, they removed the Wi-Fi they had in their own home. The child was not going to school, and the heart was perfectly normal. So we're having unnecessary surgeries and unnecessarily medication giving to people who are responding to the electromagnetic energy in their environment and are not having otherwise heart problems. This is unfortunately how some children use Wi-Fi enabled computers. They're exposing their ovaries, their breasts, all of the internal organs in their body. One of the things I'm interested in is figuring out how do we diagnose individuals? What can a doctor do in their office to look at that? And one of the things I started looking at was blood, and this is my own blood. This is called a live blood analysis. You simply prick your finger, put it on a slide, put it under the microscope and have a look at it. And this is what my blood looked like, which is relatively healthy individual cells floating around. This is what my blood looked like 60 minutes after I used a computer that was not Wi-Fi enabled. And this is what my blood looked like when I used a cordless phone for 10 minutes. And basically, a computer on Wi-Fi is the equivalent of a computer and a cordless phone. That's what you're being exposed to. Let's look at some Wi-Fi facts. The type of Wi-Fi base stations that are used in schools are industrial-based. They're much stronger than the Wi-Fi units you have in your home because they have to reach a larger area. They also have to service a larger population. They are constantly on, so they're on for the entire 6-hour period that your child is at school. This radiation is pulsed, and the research looking at continuous wave versus pulsed radiation shows that the pulsing is what's causing a lot of the damage, so it's much more harmful. The more students in the classroom using the Wi-Fi downloading and uploading information, the higher the exposure of everyone in that classroom. The highest exposure is going to be at the computer or at your Wi-Fi-enabled device, a lot of which you're actually holding in your hand, so you're exposed to it. There have been no studies looking at the long-term effects of low-level radiation on humans. The closest I could find was a study that came from the Zori Archives, the Dr. Zori Glazier Archives. It was a rat study that looked at long-term low-level exposure, and what they found is there was an increase in the cancers exposed to the 2.4 gigahertz frequency that was continuous wave. It wasn't pulse, so it wasn't the most harmful type of radiation, and it impaired the immune system. Those were the two responses that they got, which is likely what's happening in humans as well. Students and teachers in schools are getting sick. The teachers are afraid to mention this to the school board for fear of reprimand. There are alternatives to wireless technology. Fiber optics is one of the best, cables, Ethernet. So we don't have to use this in schools where most of the students are stationary anyway. And the guidelines we currently have are based on a heating effect. We need good biological guidelines, which are going to be a fraction of what we have currently. And that's based on a lot of the studies coming out in this book on the non-thermal effects and mechanisms of wireless electromagnetic fields. The other source of exposure to microwaves comes from antennas that are external to the school. And if you go to www.antennasearch.com, you can actually put in an address there, which is what we did here. This is the Commonwealth Club. This is what it looks like. We put in the address, and it will tell you how many antennas there are nearby. It will also give you a list of who owns the antenna, how high it is, and what the distance is from the source that you put in here. These are the data for the Commonwealth Club, and these are the values that we used for the school study that we did. The closest antenna here is 0.03 miles. There are 213 antennas within a quarter mile, and there are 1,000 antennas within 0.6 miles. We used 0.25 miles or a quarter mile because that's what the studies are showing harmful effects to adults who live near cell phone antennas. Because we think children are more sensitive, we think that additional 0.6 miles is going to be really critical. So for the study that we did, which is called the Bragg Antenna School Study, we used three different distances, and we color-coded everything because we ended up with a gazillion numbers that we had to make readily accessible, and the easiest way was to reduce it in a way that people can understand. We did this study a few years ago. Students in my class did all the hard labor looking at up the schools. We have results for over 6,000 schools attended in the United States by 2.3 million students in all the state capitals, including Washington, D.C. So that's what we focused on. The good news is that about 35% of those students are exposed to very low levels of microwave radiation because the antennas external to the school or at least far away. About half of them are in this cautionary mode, and because this was done a few years ago, I suspect that some of these actually have more antennas nearby. 10% are in the red mode, which is very harmful, and 3% have antennas very, very close to them. We have five states that are relatively clean. We have five state capitals that are relatively bad, Boston being the worst. And just to give you some information, in Boston, one school has over 700 antennas within 0.6 miles, in Atlanta, 679. What we need to do is look at these schools, find out if there are any health effects, and minimize the exposure of the radiation. And this is the results for Sacramento, California, which I thought people might be interested in. It was the 12th best state capital for the United States. I have a few recommendations. Ideally, we should have cell phone antennas at least 1,500 feet away from schools. We should monitor the radiation. The levels in school should be a fraction of the current guidelines allowed. And if there are health complaints, these need to be taken seriously by the school authorities so that they can actually do something about it. And I'm going to leave on three important points. One is that our guidelines are inadequate. We have frivolous exposure, meaning that we can use wired rather than wireless in a lot of situations that would reduce our exposure, and we're in for a microwave tsunami. Thank you.
So we've gotten a number of questions asking whether we're going to be filming this and making it available. Yes. The answer is yes, it will be available up next Wednesday at late in the day on electromagnetichealth.org. We encourage you to take the footage and share it in all of your communities. And to the degree that the panelists agree to include their PowerPoints, we'll also include those in cases where people agree. Our next speaker is Dr. Sam Milam, author of the new book called Dirty Electricity, Electrification and the Diseases of Civilization.
Well, that's the front cover of my little book. Looks like it's 120 pages. It costs about $10.50 from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They just jacked the price because I think it's selling. It was down 9:30 a couple weeks ago. And I wrote it hoping it does for electromagnetic fields what Silent Spring did for pesticides. I've been on to this. I've known about what I'm going to tell you about for 10 years. Haven't been able to get to square one on account of corruption, school officials, government, cell phone industry, utility industry. They hire the slickest attorneys and the slickest whores to promote their cases and to tell lies. So I figured the only way anything's going to happen is to get the public outraged enough to do something about it. And there's plenty to be outraged about. Here's basically what my book is about, and it's going to require a paradigm shift. If you ever buy a book, buy this one because it's one of the few books you can buy that's going to change your life, maybe save it. You know, we've heard about lifestyle disease. You know, lifestyle being responsible for diseases. Don't believe it. It's all caused by EMF, and I'll show you that in the next 15 minutes. Basically, I got 15 minutes to cover 50 years of work. So I'll do what I can. And it's not just the cancers, like brain cancer and cell phones. It's all the cancers. It's cardiovascular disease, the major killer. It's diabetes, especially diabetes. And suicide is an EMF disease. There's papers going back 20 years showing that. And what you've heard about, I won't even cover, because I think there's a looming epidemic of morbidity and mortality due to all the recent are radio frequency devices. You know, Edison started electrifying New York City in 1882, had 9 generators at the Pearl Street station, one of which survives in the Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. They're huge things called jumbo. And my evidence is that from the day he started sending electricity down the wires, he was killing people. He started with a direct current system, but it was dirty because of the copper brushes on the armature that was doing the generating. And he wrote extensively about terrible problems with arcing and wearing out his commutator on his generators. Anytime you get an arc, you put dirty electricity down the wires. What dirty electricity is, it's high-frequency voltage transients running down every wire in every electrified house and office and building in the world. Electricity is transmitted at 60 cycles in the U.S. and 50 hertz in Europe, but that's not the problem. It's the dirty electricity riding along on top of the nice sine waves that should be nice and clean that are no longer clean, and they haven't been from the very beginning. I started working in the early 60s, and this paper caught my eye, Court Brown and Dahl. Dahl was involved with the lung cancer cigarette smoking epidemiology. And it's just a remarkable paper. It showed that there's a brand new age peak. Childhood leukemia was a completely fatal disease till the 60s. And they noticed that in the UK and England in the 20s and the US in the 30s, that an age peak was coming in at about age 2 through 4. It didn't happen in U.S. blacks until the 60s. It didn't happen in the Japanese until the 60s. And remarkably, you still don't see this age peak in sub-Saharan Africa and places without electricity. And remarkably, again, it's one kind of leukemia. It's common acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the major leukemia of childhood. When I saw that, I said to myself, God, if we could figure out what new has happened to bring this, we can solve it. Well, I solved it, but it took 40 years. And nobody wants to believe it. That's why I wrote the book. There was some literature in The Lancet asking for childhood leukemia, if anybody knew about leukemia clusters. I was working at the New York State Health Department This is long before computers. So I rented a truck and trucked around a couple, 2-3 million punch cards, which are tons, sorted them, and I found a cluster that was 10 years old of childhood leukemia in Rome, New York. I investigated it thoroughly. I got the slides, interviewed all the parents, and I never put two and two together until much, much later, a Polish investigator named Smigelski showed that people in the Polish military who worked with radar and microwaves had increased cancers. And I remembered, my God, when I was walking around in Rome, New York, I could watch the radar arrays at Griffiths Air Force Base rotating, never put two and two together. And in 1982, I did the first studies that showed electrical workers had more leukemia, lymphoma, and brain cancers. So I got into this EMF business basically through the occupational stuff. Here's something I saw. I saw this. This is a tracing of the time trend of electrification. The big cities in this country were all electrified by the turn of the century. Where I live now in Olympia, Washington, part-time, it was, I think, 1902. The last farms in this country didn't get electrified until 1956. So in the 30s and 40s, you essentially had half the country, the rural areas especially, without electricity, and the urban areas with electricity. So I figured that, hey, that'd be a great chance to study leukemia. So I did that, and with one of my co-workers at the health department, this right before I retired. Couldn't get this paper published in U.S. journals. I sent it to four journals, and finally I got a word from one of the editors that it was challenging, and they didn't want to publish it, not because it wasn't good or wasn't right. In fact, she was a former editor. She's a perfect paper. She says it's politically challenging. So I published it in a UK journal. What we found is that on the right side is percent of residents is electrified. This data is available in the census for 1930, 40, and 50. And we took the census data for each state, and we showed that, and we calculated, and this is mortality, the death rate per 100,000 by single years of age. You can see as the percent of the residences in a state were electrified, the childhood leukemia rate goes up. And you can see the peak that Dahl and Court Brown described was present in U.S. data, and you can see it's gotten worse, progressively worse, up to 1960. And we did a little attributable risk, and this shows you that for a 10% increase in residences electrified, you got a 24% increase in this leukemia. Initially, it was completely fatal. Now they're saving a lot of these kids. But you see that down the bottom, the 24% was just in the age peak 2 through 4, one kind of leukemia. The kids who died under the age peak, we didn't see any relationship. I think that's really excellent evidence that there's a relationship between electrification and leukemia. Here's more modern data, and you can see this is statistics, epidemiology, and end results from the SEER registries for cancer. You can see the peak for CALL is there. And remarkably, even today, you don't see any of this in sub-Saharan Africa or places without electricity. When I was doing that study, I just coincidentally looked at some adult cancers, and I was just blown away that female breast cancer showed an 80% correlation with residential electrification. This is in 2000, and I'd been involved in studying power frequency magnetic fields. That's the 60 cycle stuff. And the epidemiology just never fit. I just couldn't believe that this weak stuff coming into our house could be causing, you know, that much breast cancer or other cancers. So this study, done quite serendipitously, almost by accident, answered the question, what was causing it? When I moved we bought a condo to escape the Seattle Olympia rains. In 2004, I moved into a condo and over in Indio, that's down inside of Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley. There was an article in the newspaper. I don't read the newspaper. My son, who was visiting, called my attention to it. And the specialist at the tumor registry for that area had been called to the school because the teachers were complaining of a cancer increase. So he gave him a song and dance. I've got the video of his presentation. 23 times he told them they had no cancer cluster, that this was in their heads. But the article was so detailed, I could count the cancer cases by type. And I went to my internet. I found out how big the school was. I knew right away it was a cluster. I've studied hundreds of clusters. I knew this was a real one. So I called the teachers and said, I'd be glad to help you. They took me up on it. He said that it appears that the teachers' cancer rates are not abnormally high, and I knew he was wrong right away. When we finally published the study, Lloyd Morgan was co-author. We had 18 cancers and 16 teachers, which is off scale. Lloyd drove down from San Francisco, from the Bay Area, and fortunately for us and for science, he brought along an oscilloscope and a meter invented by Marty Graham, who's sitting over there, Professor Graham from UC Berkeley, electrical engineer. That's Marty. This is a great little meter. You plug it into the outlets, and it tells you how much dirty electricity is there. It's measuring dV/dt, the range of change of voltage over time. It's measuring the high-frequency transients, and his meter measures between 4 and 100 kilohertz. So it's way above the 60-cycle stuff. We didn't make the measurements. I won't go through the politics, but the school refused to cooperate. I got threatened with a lawsuit for criminal trespass under Homeland Security. But anyway, we found a lot of 13 of the, I think, 45 rooms were above what the meter could measure. And the bottom line was that if you taught in a room that was hot, you had a much increased risk of cancer. And we're talking about risks that are big. Cell phone risk, you've seen, if you get 2, 3, or 4, it's amazing. We got risks up to 13 and 11 times expected. Here's the graph that puts the lie to it. John Morgan said, he said there's no cancer increase. You can see that there was a huge one. We had a nice, beautiful dose response. What really made the study, this is more luck. One of the teachers had saved the classroom assignment rosters. So we knew every classroom for every teacher for every year from 1990. And we showed that the time-weighted average, how long she worked in a room and what the room measured for dirty electricity. And the measurement was made by Ray Neutra from the California Health Department. I got the teachers to file a Cal OSHA complaint. That sucked him into it. So he made the measurements. I didn't. When I saw the data, I'm glad he did because people could accuse me of cooking the data because in my 40 years of doing this stuff, I've never seen anything so tight or so clear. It's just amazing. And there's a California Teachers Association study. All the teachers in this, they show the same cancers up that we showed at La Quinta. And then I realized this could explain the adult cancer connection. Now, I had some slides tossed out. I had 51 slides and people who knew I only had 15 minutes to cover this got rid of this. So one of the slides I wanted to show you was I've got called into another school with a worse cancer problem. It's female breast cancer. They got a cell tower right on campus, a few feet from the classrooms. Not only has it caused breast cancer, the kids are unteachable because the stuff hops them up. I filtered one of the rooms, Dr. Graham and a colleague, Dave Stetzer, market a filter that gets rid of the stuff. I got rid of it in a room, and the teacher responded, it's like somebody threw a light switch. The kids were calm, teachable, manageable. Unfortunately, she's got red pig slipped under the California system, and she just spent 12 hours getting operated on for her cancer. And she's not even 40. Okay, let's get through this quickly. Remember I showed you that half the country was electrified and half wasn't. Here's the paper. Now, at the end of this lecture, I'm going to give you my website, and all the papers are there in PDF form if you want to read them. So I wrote this paper. Again, I couldn't get it published here. I published it out of the country. And what it shows is that here's the time trend graph. If you look at the urban-rural excesses, now remember, urban is electrified around the turn of the century. You have a 66% increase of diabetes, urban over rural. Almost 50% for heart disease. suicide and for control down the bottom, automotive accidents, I think, motor vehicle accidents. So you have this huge urban excess that I'm convinced is caused by this dirty electricity exposure. Whoops, how can I go back?
Left button.
Huh?
Left.
Okay. If you look at all death rates, this is from U.S. published books. The big spike is the influenza pandemic. You see, the things are getting better over this time period because we learned how to put feces in pipes and clean up drinking water. Most of this was due to the communicable diseases. We started immunizing, smallpox, et cetera. However, whoops, we're missing some slides. What happened to this? I got a slide of this for cancer. It's going up like a shot for the same time period. I got a heart, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. They all go up from 1900. Maybe there's someplace else, but here, if you look at by states, the states on the right side, they're southern states. There's Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi. And the other little numbers, the percent of residents is electrified. You see, Mississippi only had 28% electrified. This is just for whites, white urban mortality rates, and you can see a systematic urban-rural difference in the rural areas. You don't see much of a difference in the northern states, which were almost completely electrified by then. And this is for all causes. If you look at cancers, you can see that if you live down south, you had about half or a third the cancer. If you lived in the southern cities, you had more, but not nearly as bad as up north. And it's all cancers, not just one cancer. It's heart disease, same deal. Look at Alabama, 43. Look at rural Alabama compared to, say, rural Massachusetts. Just enormous differences. Diabetes, even more dramatic. Suicide, another EMF disease. And you can see the same sorts of differences. I love this graph. Each spot is a state. And you see for rural areas where you have a variation state to state in electrification, the northern states have higher levels. You see a beautiful time trend with a nice slope. In the urban areas, which are all pretty much the same, you don't see it. Okay, here's my control group. Old Order Amish, they believe that electricity is evil. They have no electric exposure. They have very, very low cancer rates. This is all in my book. I mean, the references are there, too. I've talked to the people who study diabetics. And they say, gee, these people have the same body mass index. They're just as fat. They eat greasy, fat stuff. Yet their type 2 diabetes is 40% of ours. Alzheimer's is very rare in these people, as is suicide. Heart disease rates are low. And I picked this up recently, childhood attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There's a practice in the Midwest that covers 800 families, Amish families. They've never seen a single case. And they've never seen a case of childhood obesity. Here's my conclusions. So I just got goosed to tell I was getting close to the end here. 1940, urban rates were higher than rural rates for heart disease, malignant disease, and diabetes. Rural rates are correlated, dramatically correlated. You just don't see correlations like this unless it's real. My conclusion is the 20th century epidemic of the so-called diseases of civilization, they're all caused by electrification, not by lifestyle. And the good news is much of this is preventable, therefore. But I'm kind of worried that another epidemic is coming down the pike on account of all the recent RF stuff we've had. One thing about this is not an elective exposure. If you've got electricity in your house, you're getting exposed. Cell phones are elective. You know, I got one in my pocket. I use it maybe a minute a month if I'm going to be late for a meeting, and that's it. But every office, every building, every house has got this, and all the electric junk we're adding to the system is making the dirty electricity worse. That's enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Millam. I've gotten a lot of questions about how to measure and where you can get meters. So I just want to let you know there are a couple sources, lessemf.com, EMF Safety Store, and Alistair Phillips, who's one of the leading experts in this subject in the UK, who runs Power Watch, and he has a meter here that Eileen O'Connor has with her, and these can be found at emffields.org. Many people have also asked, where can they get a summary of this subject to hand out in their communities? And this is the document that we created after the program here in 2008, and it's specifically for it's not too technical. It's really something that you can share with your government officials. It's called Public Health SOS, the Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution, and we'll do something similar from this program. So right now we have Elizabeth Kelly, who runs the EMF Safety Alliance. She's been a health advocate in this field, focused on public policy for about 15 years. She is also the daughter of the chief designer of the first electric grid in California, and here to talk to us today about smart meters. Welcome.
Well, you know, if we think carefully about all this, there's a way we can address it. In the early 1920s, when electricity was first being built out in the UK and in the United States, the electric flat iron was introduced, and all the housewives said, yes, I want one of those, and please, power up my house. And they put up with these sagging power lines draped across their front yards, and they were proud of it because they could use this energy, this convenient device, this electric flat iron. They didn't have to stand there and heat up the coals and, you know, heat up the irons back and forth. It was great. And then in the 1980s, when the cell phone was first introduced, people were willing to put up with antennas. Well, but I need my cell phone. You know, I get calls all the time. Would you please come and make this cell tower go away? Well, they're calling me on a cell phone. You know, and when I point that out, they go, but I need the cell phone. I just don't want that near my house. You know, it's an NIMBY issue. But the other thing is now we're being asked to install smart meters on our buildings and homes, and we're asked to purchase equipment that will allow remote monitoring in our homes of our energy consumption. And suddenly people are waking up, like the people in this room and the people in California are waking up. And this is not the only place where this is happening, but this is a very good example of how people are saying, now, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about this. And there are many issues. But the one I'm here to talk about today is health. If you want to find out more about the other issues, for example, privacy, I would recommend you check with TURN, the Utility Reform Network here in San Francisco, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, because this issue is being analyzed and argued about literally all over the world. We're really at a turning point right now with smart meters, and it's unfolding daily. As of yesterday, the Division of Ratepayer Advocates within the California Public Utility Commission asked for a health study. That follows on Jared Huffman. Assembly Huffman asked for a health study a couple of months ago, which is now underway by the California Council on Science and Technology. That report will be released in January. So we're making progress in bringing focus to this health issue regarding the smart meters. That's very good. We need to have facts. We need to have a public dialogue. And that's what we're in the process of getting here in California in general. But I'm still going to go ahead and raise my serious concerns about the wisdom of installing smart meters without first doing an environmental assessment and considering the potential for harming people and the environment. Just to give a little background for those who may not know, smart meters are the intelligent endpoints for a new infrastructure. It's the largest technological development in history, in fact. And these are being installed all over the world. And they will monitor our time of use, bill us based on time of use, and encourage consumers to change their behavior in their use of electricity, eventually gas and water, and use that natural resource in off-peak hours. So it's really kind of a big behavior modification program for us, the consumer. The new grid represents the largest technological development in history, as I said. And in the United States, this grid is being set up in concert with state utility regulators. And eventually, if this plan succeeds, the grid would be federally regulated. The old electric grid we have right now is really a patchwork system that started way back in the 1880s, as Dr. Milham said. But in 1965, after there was a major power blackout in the Northeast, resulting in catastrophic losses and a baby boom, my father and other power executives formed the North American Reliability Corporation to ensure reliable bulk power supply through a power-sharing arrangement among all public and investor-owned utilities in the United States and then with Canada. And they're still negotiating with Mexico. But they saw the need for a new high-power transmission system for power lines that would improve interconnectivity between the utility companies and reliability. The Western United States is rich in renewable energy resources, but has inadequate long-distance electrical transmission capability. Well, the stimulus bill signed by President Obama in February 2009 seeks to solve these problems and more. That bill allocated an initial amount of $4.5 billion to bring the grid into the 20th century, to create more green jobs, and to educate people about energy conservation. I happened to see a C-SPAN television show one night at that time. It was a discussion being held in the U.S. Capitol among top leaders in the United States following a hearing on the national electrical grid. There was Tim Wirth from the UN Foundation, members of Congress, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, and others, Energy Secretary Chu, Bill Clinton, Albert Gore Jr., Robert F. Kennedy representing waterkeepers in NRDC, Carl Pope representing the Sierra Club, Carl Stern representing SEIU, the unions, and T-Bone Pickens, who now runs a wind association, as you know. They were celebrating the beginning of a new digital revolution called the Smart Grid Revolution, which is modeled after the wireless digital revolution that we've been living with for the last 15 years, when Clinton signed the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1986 into law. A central focus to selling the plan is getting the environmentalists on board early to promote the energy sustainability features and to overcome objections. To help along that part of their role, there was going to be money spent out of this bill for philanthropic activities. That's where the environmental groups came in, and the unions. Both of these corporate manufactured revolutions were launched without first doing an environmental assessment in the public interest to ensure health and safety protections were built in from the start. Here is the current status of the U.S. deployment of smart meters across the country. The solid blue states have more than 50% rollout. The striped states have less than 50% rollout. The goal is 51 million smart meters by 2012. PG&E in California has already installed more than 7 million since early 2009. You can see that on their website. They have a little clock, you know, because they're just putting them in all the time. Here's a digital schematic of what a smart grid looks like. Consumers will want electric car chargers, home-based power generators from wind and solar, and these will connect to one another in the energy resources from the utility, all regulated by the smart meter. Inside, consumers can opt to install home area networks like Zigbee Alliance, which has an open global operating standard to permit remote control over, for example, your thermostat, and encourage you to buy and install more and more electrical appliances and wireless-enabled devices that talk to one another using Wi-Fi and smartphone frequencies. Outside, the smart meters will collect and transmit data to the utility through the nearest wide area network. In the U.S., some meters will serve as hubs to other meters as part of a mesh network, and they will transmit data on behalf of the neighborhood. So some meters are going to be busier than others. To do this will require a variable duty cycle and location pings, which will cause intermittent high bursts of radio frequency radiation, pulsed signals. Some meters are going to be more active than others. So the key questions are at this point are there any standards governing exposure to electrical and magnetic fields? And how does the FCC radio frequency radiation guidelines apply to smart meters? Finally, are biologically based standards needed to protect health and the environment from increasing air pollution caused by electrosmog conditions? This is really what we're dealing with at this point. is an air quality issue that requires regulation to protect public health. We know how to do that. Here in California, John Goldschmidt, who preceded Raymond Neutra at the California State Health Department, wrote the air quality standards that were adopted later on by EPA. There's a model for how to do that. This is a schematic given to me by Stephen Scott, who's an RF engineer and remedial electrician, showing the spike from a smart meter burst. That's the highest peak on the chart. And compared to, say, a cell phone, it happens less often according to this particular oscilloscope reading. But it's really not a clear picture of what we've got going on here. Some people say that 45 seconds a day is about how often these smart meters will transmit. Other people say, well, it'll transmit every 90 seconds. But really, we don't know. In fact, we're having trouble finding any facts out. And I've tried. Believe me, I've tried. I've called these companies. I've asked for information nicely. I didn't take anything that wasn't given to me. And I didn't get a lot of callbacks, and I didn't get any clear answers. So that makes me very, very concerned about transparency here. In addition to the mesh networks, there are co-located meters, such as shown in this apartment complex. Well, where then do the smart gas meters go and the smart water meters go? Well, they're going to go right alongside the smart electrical meters, so they're going to be triple the radiation patterns happening. And if you happen to live next to this little nest of meters, you might want to move. An RF engineer named Rick Tell, a consulting engineer here, did a comparative chart, which is frankly what the industry likes to do, explaining what the energy output is from different wireless technologies. And so by comparison, smart meters, you know, they don't do too much compared to, say, sitting in a cyber cafe, Wi-Fi cafe, or standing within 2 inches of a microwave oven, which I don't think many people do that. But the comparisons are based on output. They're not based on energy absorption in the living tissue, which was really what we are talking about. So it's a different framework entirely. Yes, it may work, but does it really work for our bodies? This is the chart showing very simply the short and long-term exposure coverage given by the FCC in the human exposure guidelines for radio frequency radiation. As was stated already, public exposure is protected for 30 minutes. Workers are exposed every 6 minutes out of the hour. Do you see telecom workers scrambling up and down ladders every 6 minutes? No, they're not paying any attention to that. And chronic exposure does exceed 30 minutes. So we don't really have any relevancy what's going on in the world right now with these standards. And what is not known, what is not being looked at, is long-term exposure. A woman in Ontario, Canada, recently told me that she became electrically hypersensitive after a successful 24-year career where she used a cell phone, lived near antennas, so she retired and moved out to the country. And Hydro-Canada put a smart meter by her house. They wouldn't remove it. She had it put way at the end of her property. She could still feel it. She had copper mesh put behind it. She could still feel it. Now she doesn't know what to do. But a friend of hers who subscribes to Toronto Hydro Energy was told she could get a phone line cable so she wouldn't have to have a smart meter. There are a number of suggestions from RF engineers about how to do this right, but unfortunately, I'm running out of time. But there are very concerned consulting engineers who take measurements of exposure for people who are very competent. They've been looking at this too, and they're working hard to come up with an exposure metric. And they have a number of questions about what kind of exposure we're receiving and how to test it. I wish there were more time so I could run through these. I'd like to just end, which is a little earlier than I planned to, but I'm trying to stay within the time frame, by telling people that in 1997, I was one of the leading appellants challenging the Federal Telecommunications Act, Section 704. We filed an appeal in the appellate court level, because we believe that 704 is wrong because it preempts states from looking after the health of the people when they have to place antennas over the objections of people like ourselves who are concerned about health and other things. Well, we also challenged these guidelines as being inadequate, and we supplied over 4,000 pages of science. American court system doesn't look at science. The case was denied. And Whitney North Seymour is going to be speaking in a few minutes, led our Supreme Court appeal with a passionate brief on our behalf. And he'll be speaking to you now, and I'm going to end my comments right now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We've gotten a number of questions also on how can people help themselves through nutrition and things like that. And while that isn't the focus of today's program, I do want to point out that we have Anne-Louise Gittleman in the audience today. Anne-Louise, raise your hand. She's the author of the new book called Zapped and has all kinds of prescriptions for how you can support your system through diet and nutrition. Okay, so we have a few more and more questions. It's like Christmas. Okay, what is the connection between dirty electricity and cell towers?
Well, you know, all transmitters, the electrical guts run on direct current. Cell towers are no different. Now, unless they run on batteries, which none of them do, they plug into the grid. But they have in their base or close to it a switch mode power supply which changes the AC to the DC. That interrupts the current, generates lots of dirty electricity unless it's engineered properly, and it gets into the grid. I'm studying a school in Palm Springs where there's a breast cancer epidemic. The tower is just feet from a classroom, and the teachers in that wing of the school have developed breast cancer since the tower's been up.
The radiation from a cell tower can actually get onto the wires and re-radiate in the room. And I think that some of the people who are getting sick because of living near cell towers are actually getting sick because of the secondary re-radiation.
What can we do to protect ourselves when the meter is placed on the bedroom wall? Smart meters.
I think the meter should be moved. I mean, you shouldn't put up with that. We don't really know how far this signal transmits. The parameters that the FCC put out are inaccurate, according to the consulting engineers I've been speaking with. So you don't want to be close to these meters at all.
There are metal shields that will shield the radiation from a smart meter. And once again, the radiation from the smart meter can get onto the wire and re-radiate in other parts of the house. So what Libby says is correct. They really need to be moved and replaced with using wires for having smart meters rather than smart meters.
Mm-hmm. Are there EMF exposure risks from riding in or recharging either hybrid or all electric cars?
Yes, some of the cars are really hot inside. I've measured power frequency fields. Unfortunately, there's no place to plug in a dirty electricity meter, but I've used oscilloscopes and other meters. It all depends on the car. When I bought my pickup, I tried a whole bunch of different vehicles, and some of them were notoriously bad. And when they get into all electric cars, it's bound to be worse.
And the battery emits magnetic fields that are quite high, and once again, they can be shielded. So there is technology available to clean up a lot of these problems. They're not being used because the industry doesn't think there's a harmful effect, and the government isn't regulating it.
Mm-hmm. Does home power generation by solar or wind on the roof create exposure levels of concern?
Well, it doesn't have to, but I've measured wind farms, commercial wind farms, measured the ground currents, and they're filthy. And some of the home solar generating systems create all sorts of dirty electricity. Some are clean. And there's one I know is clean, but I don't want to advertise it. It's Sunny Boy's a clean system. Sunny Boy.
Mm-hmm. City councils allow 3 minutes each for public comments. How can we pick a speaker from today and edit it down to 3 minutes? If you want to do that for your city councils to actually modify the footage, just be in touch with me at Camilla@electromagnetichealth.org. There are several speakers today who just don't want their footage circulating everywhere without association with the Commonwealth Club, so we have to do it correctly. But be in touch with me, and we'll make it happen if you want to use chop up some of the footage. As an elected official, I am limited by the federal government guidelines for cell towers that do not allow our city to consider health effects, only the recommended guidelines for exposure. What can we, the citizens, do? They are very upset about being in the range of cell towers?
Well, the problem is we don't have the definitive science on cell towers yet. That's epidemiology. But there is a lot of research on clinical exposures to cells, living cells, for example, showing DNA damage and heat shock protein release, and you've been hearing about that today, and other frequencies. Extremely low frequency from power lines and electrical appliances is classified as a human carcinogen by NIH and the World Health Organization. So that's non-ionizing radiation, too. I also want to point out that this was in my talk, so I'm going to insert this because it's important. B. Blake Levitt and Dr. Henry Lai just published a paper in a Canadian Environmental Health Journal. They reviewed over 100 cell antenna studies, and they selected about 53 of those studies that were methodologically sound. And they compared the findings, and what they found were there were common neurological effects, near-term effects, which may or may not be reversible, which may be related to electrical hypersensitivity and could result in diseases. And that includes the ones that many people here talk about. And sleeplessness, depression, concentration, memory, and so forth. And if anybody is interested in speaking with people who are electrically hypersensitive and some of the doctors who treat them, they're going to be meeting downstairs at the door right after this program and would like to speak with you.
Okay. Why are antennas sited on school sites? Do they get money for school from wireless technologies? And also, where can schools get information about the health hazards from antennas and Wi-Fi?
You bet. They get $2,000 a month. The school I'm working with right now, they're very reluctant to give up that money. I mean, budget crisis. And so they hired an industry shill who came and told them everything's within published limits, everything's hunky-dory. The kids are getting transferred out of school because they can't learn. They're hyperactive. The teachers get cancer, but everything's wonderful. I can't get the superintendent of schools to talk to me. And so we've gone through this twice. The La Quinta school, the teachers moved away en masse. They've got new teachers who are still getting exposed. And money and corruption are trumping science. That's why I wrote the book. I'm just so frustrated by it.
Magda, do you want to say something on that?
No.
Okay, and the final question for this panel is, how do we stop the CPUC from having the legislated right to impose so-called smart meters on us?
Well, the mission of the CPUC is to look after the people. I mean, I've read their mission statement, and I think they need to live up to that. And if it means that they're going to have to suspend operations and look at a health study and hold a public debate, well, maybe they should, but that's up to us to ask for it. You know that? They need to hear from all of us.
Okay, so we'll have a 7-minute break. Thank you to all the panelists, and be back here in 7 minutes. Sorry to have to be on such a tight schedule.